This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we run down a number of updates, including assassinations.
Assassinations carried out, we believe, by Israel, probably with the agreement of the United States, in Iran, of their nuclear scientists. What else do we have, Michael?
Developments in England, your report, your trip to London.
Which includes a report on the 10th anniversary, caged prisoners, my discussions with Guantanamo detainees, discussions at Occupy London about Bradley Manning, and my updates on Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in London.
We'll learn about a new site called HonestAppalachia.org.
Inspired by WikiLeaks, this new site allows anonymous uploading of documents revealing corporate and government misdeeds.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, we all had the good news over the last few weeks that Mumia was taken off death row and is no longer facing the death penalty. I know there's other issues you want to talk about with Mumia, and I know you just had a visit with Mumia. So why don't you tell us what's going on with Mumia? Where is he? How was your visit?
Mumia was transferred from the facility SCI Green, where he'd been on death row for 17 years, 17 of the past 30 years in that facility, and he was transferred to SCI Mahanoy, which is in Frackville, Pennsylvania.
SCI means?
A state correctional institution. It's about 2.5 hours from New York, so it makes it a lot easier to visit him than in the other location.
Is that where you visited him, in his new location?
I've been to his new location 3 times.
Wow.
Yes, and it's actually a medium security facility. The problem is that Mumia is held in what's called administrative custody in the restrictive housing unit there. So he was literally taken off death row and moved into solitary confinement, where he is shackled and handcuffed whenever he leaves his cell. His number of weekly visits has been reduced to 1, and that's just for 1 hour. That doesn't include legal visits, which can last for several hours.
Let me ask, when you visit him, and I want you to go on, but he comes into the room or wherever you visit him in shackles?
Yes. And it's noteworthy that years ago at SCI Green, he also was in shackles until Desmond Tutu visited him a few years ago and complained that this was inhumane treatment because essentially he's behind thick plexiglass in a small, you know, 4x6, roughly, foot holding unit. And there are little perforated holes on the side so you can hear each other. But so now he's back in the shackles. His phone call privileges have been
reduced.
Wait
a second. You talk to him through a wall?
Yes. You're sitting on one side of a thick plexiglass partition. So you're in the same room, but it's divided in half by plexiglass. So anyway, his phone call privileges have been reduced. He can only have, I think it's 10 stamps and envelopes a week. And as a writer, you can well imagine that Mumia writes probably at least 10 letters a day. So this is a dramatic change. He doesn't have his radio or TV.
Books?
I think he only has 4 books. At first he had none, then they allowed him 4. The National Lawyers Guild, along with the Human Rights Research Fund, which is co-chaired by Kathleen Cleaver and Natsu Saito, sent a letter to the Department of Corrections on January 11th calling for him to be moved into general population, as he was supposed to have been when he left SCI Green. And we cited, as listeners probably know, that for over a century, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized the psychological damage that results from being held in solitary. There was a case in 1890, In re Medley. Also, the Commission on Safety and Abuse in America a few years ago found that the increasing use of punitive segregation is not only counterproductive, but results often in violence inside facilities, and it also contributes to post-release recidivism. Juan Mendez, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, just a few weeks ago called for a ban on solitary confinement longer than 15 days, reiterating that it amounts to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. As a result, the People's Movement has really been calling the facility. We are disheartened to note that there were rumors that Mumia was going to be moved into general population as of last Thursday, and that has, of this airing not yet happened.
Tell me, Heidi, he has not been moved yet, and what can people do?
People can call. We'll put a link to where to the website that has all this information, but they can basically call the superintendent of SCI Mahanoy. They can call Seth Williams, the DA in Philadelphia. They can fax. We'll provide those fax numbers. I truly know that the prison has been amazed at the outpouring of support for Mumia. He gets hundreds of letters often in a single day, definitely hundreds in a week. He reports, I think I mentioned recently, that the French especially sent him lots of letters.
They named a street after
they
a
named
city,
it. They
right?
have a stamp, right now, a Mumia yeah. stamp as well as a street.
Really? They have
yeah,
a stamp
they've
in
currently
France?
Have a stamp. A oh, Mumia stamp.
To drive American Congress to not eat French fries.
Exactly.
That's incredible.
But put lawanddisorder.org is our website, and you can go there to get the phone numbers Heidi just mentioned.
I have a follow-up question, Heidi. When you visit him, I mean, I have visited many prisoners in my day, and I always found it really, I mean, it's obviously more difficult for the prisoner, but the visiting is such a total drag and outrage what they put you through. So you drive to this prison, and what happens when you get there? You're on a list?
You're on a list, so they check the computer to make sure you're on his list of approved visitors. Although, for this facility, they asked if we could give a day or two notice, just as a courtesy, I guess, because he's been getting several legal visitors. Also, members of the Pennsylvania Prison Society are allowed to go visit and spend more than an hour. But this facility is actually, it is medium security, so it's a lot less strict than SCI Green was. They check your hands and your body for drug exposure. You go through a metal detector. But other than that, I must say that the personnel at the facility were very accommodating and very nice.
I'm going to visit David Gilbert in Auburn next week. Let's hope they treat me the same way they treated you, Heidi.
Exactly.
I have a last question about Mumia. We know that he is no longer facing the death penalty, but he is facing a life in prison. And is there any legal action going on right now? Is there any contemplated that you can talk about?
I think now that Mumia is closer to being in general population, the movement has grown so excited, and we had a fabulous event we've talked about with 1,200 people on December 9th in Philly at the Constitution Center. I think just having him move off death row has been such a huge accomplishment and motivator for thousands of supporters around the country that I think we've really seen a revitalized movement that is going to continue to gain in momentum.
But wouldn't it take an act of clemency on the part of the governor of the state of Pennsylvania to get him out?
It would take that, and it would also legally take new evidence that could not have been discovered before this point. And so,
I mean, that's for if you were to do a separate action.
If you were to do a separate legal action, it would take new evidence that for some reason might not have been able to have been discovered. We still hope for that, but we also hope that the renewed movement will result in freeing Mumia.
I mean, look, this was a major victory. I mean, this was, he was supposed to die many times, for many years.
Where there's life, there's hope.
And this was
exactly
a huge people's victory, and of course,
yes,
to Mumia's own strength.
Yes.
So thank you, Heidi. I know you've been visiting him for many years, and it's remarkable that you're keeping it up and doing great now.
Michael, you're from the Midwest, and I know you've been keeping abreast of things that are happening out there. What's happening with the Chicago Tribune and Occupy there?
This is an amusing story. As we reported, the Occupy people put out the Occupy Chicago Tribune, which really irritated this grand Chicago newspaper. So they went after the Occupy people, and they said, we're going to bring a lawsuit against you. We're going to stop you. We're going to fine you. We're going to crush you. And the Occupy people were afraid. Luckily, they got a hold of Arun Gupta, who had started the Occupy Wall Street Journal here and who was traveling around the country doing articles in preparation for a Haymarket book on the Occupy movement nationwide. So Arun said, well, I'll call up my friends in New York and see if I can get you some help. So he gave me a call. I called up Peter Weiss, who's the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's just retired, he's 87, just retired, one of the preeminent trademark lawyers in the country. Peter said, I'll help, and did the research on what the law is here in New York. But, of course, you have to do the research out in Chicago. And so we called up the People's Law Office. I spoke with my nephew there, Ben Elson, and Michael Deutsch, who are both partners in the People's Law Office. Ben did the research out there based on what Peter had contributed here. Michael Deutsch, who's the former legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, called up the attorney for the Chicago Tribune. And this is what he told him. He said, look, you guys want to bring a lawsuit? Go ahead. But you're going to lose this lawsuit. And I'm telling you why you're going to lose it. And I'm going to show you the legal research we've done. So if you go ahead and bring a lawsuit in the face of your being 100% wrong, because, you know, an intellectual property law says you have a right to parody something. And the rule is, if you can cause confusion and cost the outfit money, you know, then you shouldn't do it. But you can't confuse the Occupy Chicago Tribune with the Chicago Tribune. Or the other law is, well, if you dilute the content of the Chicago Tribune and somehow cause some money. But there's no question here that we're absolutely right. So Michael Deutsch says, you do this, and we're going to ask for sanctions against you. Well, the Chicago Tribune lawyer was really flustered, and he backed off, and nobody heard anything from him for 5 days. So we thought we had won, you know, because it was a win-win situation. If they bring the lawsuit, they're going to look like fools, they're going to lose, and they're going to give the Occupy movement all kinds of publicity. So we thought we won. Then we found out just this morning, I spoke with Ben Elson, that the Chicago Tribune called up and said, we're not backing off, we're going forward, and we want to mediate this. So Michael Deutsch said, no way. We're not going to let you mediate this. You're going to get the publicity you deserve. Bring the lawsuit. And that's where it stands now.
Fabulous.
So we'll see. But I wanted to just tell you, the Occupy Chicago Tribune, you can get it online. It says Occupy Chicago Tribune. And over in the corner it says media for the 99%. And then it has the following disclaimer on the bottom. We're proud to have no affiliation whatsoever with the 1% Chicago Tribune or the Tribune Company.
Brilliant. Michael, you've been globe-trotting of late, and you were just in London. Why were you there?
As our listeners, I'm sure, are aware, on January 11th, we passed the 10th anniversary of the Guantanamo Detention Center and really other kinds of detention all over the country. Here on Law and Disorder, we did a lot of reporting on that over the years, and we did a lot for the 10th anniversary. But I went to London this time because they were also commemorating the 10th anniversary of Guantanamo. And I decided to go to London rather than to Washington, D.C., where we had, with the center and Amnesty, a lot going on. I decided to go to London because I could spend the time with Center for Constitutional Rights clients and people who'd been freed from Guantanamo. And as much as I'd been acquainted with some of those over time, it was one of the more moving experiences that I've ever had. I spent 3 days with a group called Cage Prisoners, which was actually started by Mozem Beg, who was one of the UK, United Kingdom, clients who was eventually freed from Guantanamo and is an incredibly articulate spokesman on behalf of the people at Guantanamo. There's still one English person still there, one UK person, Shaka Amar. Shaka Amar has been there for not one, but 10 years, without charges, without trial, and he's actually been cleared for release. So what's he doing there? We have no idea. The British claim they have asked to get him back, but of course that's got to be not true, because let me tell you, if the UK wanted him back, if Cameron wanted him back, they would have him back yesterday. So we had a number of events, and one place I'd like people to go is the Cage Prisoners website. It's an extraordinarily interesting website. And one thing we always give at least lip service, if not more to, is that clients should be in the forefront and lead what is going on in the political take on things. And that's one of the important things about Cage Prisoners, because they bring together people who've essentially been in cages in the so-called war on terror, not just in Guantanamo, but in Bagram, and people who've been rendered, etc. And I won't go through all the events, but one really moving event was the movie we saw that was made by a Norwegian filmmaker called Death in Camp Delta. And it's about the claimed suicide of three people who were at Guantanamo, one being Yasser al-Zahrani, who was 21 years old, I think, when he supposedly committed suicide. But it's pretty clear from the film that he was murdered. Cage Prisoner showed it at a movie theater in the heart of London. And I was sitting there next to Sami El-Haj. Sami El-Haj was Sudanese. He was in Guantanamo for 6.5 years. And he was, of course, the only journalist in Guantanamo. He now works as the human rights coordinator for Al Jazeera in Qatar, in Doha, Qatar. And he's an incredibly wonderful guy. I mean, incredibly moving, warm guy. So I'm sitting watching this movie, and they're talking about the hunger strikes going on at Guantanamo. And I'm sitting next to Sammy, and Sammy's interviewed in the movie, and Sammy talks about how he was on a hunger strike for well over a year. And then he describes how they took this big, fat feeding tube, and they stuffed it down through his nose and into his stomach, not once, but twice a day, while he's strapped into a, quote, feeding chair. And then the movie flashes to the administrator, an administrator at Guantanamo, who is being interviewed by news people, who talks about how they are saving people's lives through this, and how this is this, quote, feeding chair is this way in which people get fed, and how now, after a couple of years, people are getting cooperative with it, and they even tell the guy which nostril to put the feeding tube down. And, of course, the feeding tube comes up with blood on it and everything else when you take it off. So I'm sitting next to Sammy, and I mean, I'm flabbergasted, and I just can't believe that Sammy isn't more, you know, angry about it, that he's still fighting. He's fighting to get the other people released. He's in Qatar working for Al Jazeera. And when you look at the film is about that, but it's also about what happened to those guys at Guantanamo and the torture that took place. And we had a panel right after that. This is one of many events I went to in London. We had a panel where I was on the panel with Mozambique, Sami El-Haj, and Omar Dagahis, who was also a Guantanamo detainee, clients at various times of the center or of Reprieve in London. And it was extraordinary to sit there. And they asked questions of us. And my main reaction was I was just devastated by the film. And I've been through this a lot with Guantanamo. But when you see the inhuman treatment that we, the United States, meted out to the people in Guantanamo, you just can't. It's just so off the wall and so outrageous.
How did they get footage of things like the feeding tube? Was that a reenactment?
They interviewed Sami El-Haj.
Right.
But when reporters go there, they contrasted what Sami El-Haj and other Guantanamo freed detainees said about Guantanamo with the cook's tour that they give journalists of Guantanamo.
Potemkin Village.
You just can't believe it. So they're interviewing, like, a guy who's in charge of the feeding, quote, feeding. Then they interview somebody who shows you the exercise yard and how here they get their exercise. And then they interview you about, they take you into a mock cell and they say, well, here's where we put the Quran, here's their blanket, here's this. And it's just such, contrast that with the testimony of the detainees, and it's utter shock. And there's a lot more I can say about London and the detainees, but my main thing I came away from, I guess, were two or three things. One is the warmth and the drive of the former Guantanamo detainees was incredible. I mean, it was an experience that once you go through that with the detainees, it's outrageous to begin with, but you realize what incredible human beings they are. And secondly, that the place still exists is, like, incredible to me. I mean, I just can't even imagine why they continue Guantanamo. And we kept debating this issue, why is it still there? And one question is it there because they continue to want to send a message to the Muslim world? You do this, you will be at Guantanamo. And I met a former soldier who was in London who had worked for the British, the equivalent of Delta Force. And I asked him about, and he had quit, and he was at Occupy London, where I also spoke at Occupy London, which is a whole other story, which was wonderful. And he said one of the things they did when he was in the British, quote, Delta Force, whatever it's really called, he said one of the things they did is they would tell people, you either comply with us or you're going to be sent to Guantanamo. And so that was one of the scary things they did. So when we think about Guantanamo, maybe it actually is serving a purpose for the United States. But as we go on with the 11th year, We just encourage our listeners to get active on this.
Where can listeners see this film? Is it publicly available?
It's not yet. We hope to have a showing here in New York. It's called Death at Camp Delta. We hope in the next couple of months to show the film. It's quite remarkable, and you reach a definite conclusion that this 21-year-old kid, Yasser al-Sirani, was murdered by our country.
You know, they're not closing Guantanamo. The new military authorization for funds act provides for their not allowing the people who are there to come here. They have nowhere to send them, so they can't close Guantanamo.
Right. It's built in. You're talking about the NDAA, and it's going to make it very hard to close it. And not, I mean, they could have closed this thing a long time ago.
Michael, I want to ask you what you think should be done about this. Last week, the Israelis assassinated the fifth Iranian scientist. This one was a young man, 34 years old. A motorcycle came up behind his car. They clapped a bomb onto the car, blew up, and killed him. Isn't killing civilians to influence policy the very definition of terrorism? And shouldn't the International Criminal Court be involved in something like this?
Michael, let's unpack your statement first. First, we don't know if the Israelis did it. Okay?
They smile and they don't deny it.
Right.
Okay.
It's likely the Israelis did it, but we don't know that because there was no tag on the bullet. But, of course, the Israelis, you know, they've done things in the past. They do this kind of stuff. So does the United States. Now, the United States, Hillary Clinton categorically denied it. But it does seem that both Israel and the United States, their main interest right now seems to be in somehow attacking Iran and somehow overthrowing the government and stopping the, quote, push toward what the U.S. and Israel claims is an atomic or nuclear weapon. And this is the fourth or fifth nuclear scientist who has been murdered, is the only way to say it, assassinated is another way, murdered in Iran, whether by the Israelis or the United States or some, or the U.S. gave the approval. So I think it is likely the Israelis did it, but we don't know. But it's the most likely.
But let me add this to the mixture, Michael, and maybe I'll defeat your skepticism here.
No, I'm not. Michael,
there was,
I'm 95% sure. In fact, I'm probably 100%, but I don't have it in writing.
Well, there was an important article in the magazine Foreign Policy, an important publication of the establishment here in the United States, written by an author named Mark Perry. Perry said that on the basis of interviews he's conducted, he is convinced that the assassinations in Iran were done by a Pakistani terrorist organization which was approached by the Israel Mossad. But the Israeli Mossad said they were CIA agents. Got them to do it in the name of the CIA, which has caused a big tumult in the American government that they're being used in that way.
Well, look, the world knows that this has the fingerprints of Israel and probably the United States as well. So that's what we have here. We seem to be running a covert war against Iran, not just these assassinations, but on the borders and arming groups of people, et cetera. And we're running a covert war because I think the idea of a big war against Iran is something that is very difficult even for our gung-ho government to do, whether it's U.S. or Israel, because you already have a bad problem in the Middle East and Central Asia. And Iran is a serious country. That's a big country. That's not pushing over even Iraq. Iran is a really serious place to go into. So I'm not convinced there'll be a war. So what the U.S. is trying to do, there's a war of some sort now, but there's this covert operation going on, and they're knocking these guys off. Your legal question, of course, it's a war crime. I mean, it's a crime. You can't. First, it's murder, let's start from there, under Iranian law. Secondly, you can't cross a border or go into another country to kill somebody. And the guy isn't even in the military, but it wouldn't make any difference if he was in the military or not who was killed, because we're not at a war with Iran in any kind of real way. So it's straight murder. That's what it is. And, of course, it would be an International Criminal Court violation, except for the fact that neither Iran nor the United States belongs to the International Criminal Court, nor does Israel, of course. That's not the issue, but basically, this is a heavy, heavy crime. And what's amazing is the snooze that is being given to this crime in the West. Really, it's as if the newspapers and everybody else is asleep. This is a regular thing that we go in and today we wake up and today we're going to go kill another 35-year-old, quote, nuclear scientist in Iran. Now, let me just make another point about this. We hear all about building a bomb and building a bomb. And there's two points I'd like to make. One, Iran is not violating the law in enriching uranium right now. Under the treaty they signed, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, they're allowed to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes. And all they're doing is enriching uranium.
They're doing it under the supervision of an international commission. Their plants have television cameras in them. They're about to be visited by a delegation.
Right. That's starters. What the U.S. or Israel would claim is that once you enrich uranium, then you're closer, if you ever wanted to making a bomb. But we're not at that point, and they're not violating the treaty now. My view of that is if they wanted people to stop enriching uranium, the United States should have shoved a different treaty down the throats of the world. But they didn't, and so they're complying with the treaty. So what the heck is the U.S. and or Israel doing in murdering people? The second thing is, and as I said, I have no idea whether Iran will one day make a bomb or not make a bomb, but after Gaddafi's experience in Libya, you have to say to yourself, why wouldn't they make a bomb? People should remember what happened in Libya. Gaddafi made a deal where he would give up his ability to make a bomb and join all the groups of people that said, we won't have a bomb. Of course, had Gaddafi had a bomb, there would not have been a UN resolution. There wouldn't have been a NATO invasion. There wouldn't have been any of that. If you're sitting there in some country that the U.S. wants to knock off in the Middle East, what's your best protection, Michael?
Well, you certainly would understand that if they did try to build a bomb. But the fact is that everything we know is that they're not. The disturbing thing is that the American media seems to be going along with the story that they are. Last week, National Public Radio, NPR, National Defense Radio, had an article that would suggest that, and they were criticized by FAIR, but they wouldn't withdraw it. The New York Times has been kind of going along with the story, just like they did with Judy Miller in Iraq years ago. So it's very disturbing that this slide towards war is being facilitated by the major mass media in America.
No, it is. And I just want to reiterate the point. What the U.S. or Israel, most likely Israel right now, but certainly maybe with the approval of the U.S., is doing is carrying out murder in Iran. And secondly, as you pointed out and as I have, right now Iran is undergoing no activities vis-a-vis atomic energy that are not authorized by the treaty they signed. And third, that we basically have the West ignoring it, snoozing it, or really smiling and approving it.
Yeah, and I would add a fourth point, too, that both the U.S. and Israel are no strangers to political assassination. In our book about Che, we showed that they tried to killed 18 different foreign leaders from 1948 up to the point where they assassinated Che in 1967. The Israelis are notorious for assassinating leaders of the Palestinian people. So it's not a point of principle about either one of these countries. I think they may have a tactical difference here. It's nothing that they draw back from doing.
Welcome to our lawless world, law and disorder.
Michael, you just came back after visiting occupied London, and in addition to working with caged prisoners, I understand you also visited occupied London.
Yes, Michael. At one of the events for the Guantanamo detainees, someone approached me and said, Michael, we'd love you to come and speak at Occupy London, particularly speak about Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning, of course, the alleged whistleblower who supposedly gave documents to WikiLeaks, everything from the collateral murder video of the helicopters killing Reuters journalists in Iraq to the State Department cables, etc.
Well, he's just been approved for trial. One of the charges is aiding the enemy.
Yes, that's right, Michael, and that's one of the reasons they wanted me to go speak, and that was right after that approval of the charges. What actually happened in Manning, and then I'll talk about going to Occupy London, is he was tried in what's called an Article 32. It's like here in the United States, a grand jury, a preliminary hearing, to see if there's enough evidence to have him stand trial for a full court-martial. The judge, while I was in Occupy London, he's not a judge, the investigating officer, who is not neutral like a judge at all. In fact, there was a motion to disqualify the guy for good reason, because he works for the State Department. But in any case, he came down with his ruling after this hearing that all 22 charges should be preferred against Bradley Manning in the court-martial, including, as you just said, Michael, the aiding the enemy charge, which does carry a death penalty. Now, the prosecutor has said, we're not going to ask for the death penalty. We're just going to ask for life in prison. But I don't think the ultimate court-martial is restricted by what the prosecutor asks for. He could still conceivably get the death penalty. But all 22 charges were confirmed by the investigating officer. The charges then go to convening authority, and the convening authority, this is just a military general going up the chain of command, has to decide, is he going to confirm that charge and put him in a general court-martial? The chances are obviously very high that Manning will face a general court-martial in which he could get a life sentence. Now, one of the reasons I think that came out at the hearing on the Article 32 that they're charging him so heavily, including an aiding the enemy charge, is what the lawyer for Manning said is that they're want to give him a very severe sentence, or they want to charge him very severely, and that's why they put him into that underground torture cell, is because they want him to eventually, quote, spill the beans on Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, assuming he knows any beans, which none of us know. But the lawyer said that explicitly. And so why I didn't expect the charges to be lessened at this stage against Bradley Manning is because Bradley Manning, as far as we know, has never, maybe he doesn't know anything, but has never said anything to the government about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And so the pressure is continuing. In any case, so I get approached in London to go to Occupy London. And I did. And I'd been to the site before in London, not the site of Occupy London, but the place where it actually is, which is in the most prominent cathedral, maybe except for Westminster, in London. It's called St. Paul's, and it's right across from a thing called the Millennium Bridge. And it's this beautiful, big old church, and entirely surrounding the church are huge tents. Not like we have our little pup tents in New York or in other occupies. These are like those huge hunter tents that are connected to each other where there's libraries and kitchens. And the cops have basically let the place be. And there's other sites in London. There's one called the Bank of Ideas, which may be my favorite. The Bank of Ideas is where a lot of ideas get shared, and they've taken over an old bank building, no less, and they call it the Bank of Ideas. In any case, the people at Occupy London were very interested in what was happening with Bradley Manning and very concerned, obviously. People probably don't know, but Bradley Manning is half Welsh. His mother lives in and was born in Wales. So the British government should have a lot more interest in protecting his rights, and they don't seem to have so far.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. If you're just joining us, we continue Michael Smith and Michael Ratner's discussion on Bradley Manning, as well as Michael Ratner's recent trip to London.
In any case, I spoke about Bradley Manning, and then, of course, Julian Assange is under house arrest, roughly house arrest, with he has a one of those bands around his leg that he can only be out for a certain number of hours every day. And of course, Bradley Manning's case, according to many, is related to Julian Assange's case. So Bradley Manning, we don't expect a court-martial probably till sometime in early June, but we'll have to see what happens in the next few months. As regard Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, as people also are probably aware, there's been an extradition hearing to try and get Julian Assange to go to Sweden, to force him to go to Sweden to answer charges having to do with alleged rape in Sweden, what the Swedish law defines as rape. And he's been resisting it, and the lawyers have been doing, the current lawyers who are Gareth Pearce, a prominent British solicitor, formerly represented the Irish hunger strikers, has been representing Julian, and he actually got a big break on his appeal, and the highest court, the Supreme Court of England, which is the old House of Lords Court, is actually going to hear the appeal. And it's being heard over a two-day argument on February 1st and 2nd in London. It's an interesting issue, and I'll just describe it briefly. The issue is, underlying it is, should he be extradited to Sweden from England? And it's under what's called the European Extradition Warrant. Within the EU, the European Union, they have a special procedure that makes it look like from state to state. If I'm going to extradite a criminal from New York to Alabama, there's not a lot New York can do if it all comes in order, and there's not much you can do. It's a pretty easy extradition. The wrinkle here is the official who requested Julian's extradition to Sweden, the Swedish person, is a prosecutor and not a judge. In other words, not a, quote, neutral magistrate. And it's a prosecutor who obviously has an interest in vindicating his or her prosecutorial interests. It appears that the European system requires that the person who asks for you, who wants you extradited, has to be a neutral magistrate, not a prosecutor. So the issue in Julian's case is the Swedish prosecutor the equivalent of a neutral magistrate or judge under the European arrest warrant? And it's such an important issue that the court in London has made seven judges hear it instead of the usual five. And so it's going to be a pretty remarkable argument. Now, I can't say whether there's hope or not on it, and there may be some wrinkles in Julian's case they try and figure out. But right now, it sounds to me like a very solid issue, because a prosecutor shouldn't be able to just extradite whoever they want without the charges going through a neutral magistrate.
Well, it sounds even more, you could speculate something fishy about this. Why couldn't they get a magistrate to recommend it? And maybe there's some kind of fix in it, or maybe some kind of pressure by the United States government with this prosecutor to do it.
No, it's an interesting question. So I am hopeful that on the arguments on February 1st and 2nd, that Julian has a chance of prevailing on that issue. The worries, of course, are that if he goes to Sweden, I'm not convinced at all that he'll ever be charged in Sweden with the sex crimes. I'm not convinced about that. But I am convinced that it'll be easier for the United States to get their hands on Julian Assange from Sweden than it will from London. And I say that even though both have extradition treaties with the United States, etc., but London has a really firm legal tradition of extradition lawyers who are incredible at fighting extradition. And there's lots of wrinkles in the UK law about him ever getting to the United States, whereas I think Sweden is a smaller country with less experienced lawyers, has an easier time of just bowing to the interests of the United States than the judges will in London. So as we go forward, we'll be seeing both the developments of what happens with Bradley Manning, what happens with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange.
But Michael, don't we have to admit that even though they haven't got Assange in the dock yet, either in Sweden or in the United States, they have closed down WikiLeaks. They prevented him from getting money. They've got an ankle bracelet around Assange, and they got him under house arrest. They've crippled the project. And my question to you is, what was it about WikiLeaks? What kind of information did they release that caused this kind of reaction on the part of the American government?
I would say that they've certainly injured the WikiLeaks site. The main thing, I think, was cutting off the funding. And when I say they, it's MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, cut off the funding for WikiLeaks. That reminds me of really what's going on with the SOPA law, with the Internet Privacy Law, because here you have these private corporations, MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, deciding on their own, despite there having been no criminal charges against WikiLeaks, deciding on their own, we don't like WikiLeaks, we're going to cut their money off. So WikiLeaks got really damaged badly, and it's very hard to run these websites around the world without money. On the other hand, WikiLeaks is still running, still publishing documents, still getting stuff up there, but it's obviously much more difficult. As to the kind of information, well, we first had the collateral murder video of two Reuters journalists being killed from a helicopter, the excitement of the U.S. soldiers in the helicopter, and then the shooting of two children, and then the shooting of people who went out to get the bodies back to try and rescue the people.
Yeah, and here Bradley Manning was charged with releasing that film. He's a hero, really. And the people that did the murders weren't charged with anything, right?
Well, there's a great new road sign up in Washington that basically says, arrest war criminals, not whistleblowers. And that's really what should be happening right now. There's two things that leads to as we continue these updates. One is the new site we're going to talk about later today, which is Honest Appalachia, and the fact that WikiLeaks has its progeny, Honest Appalachia, or Honest Appalachia, being one of those progeny. And it's exciting to hear that WikiLeaks has inspired other sites, and we're very, very excited to bring you that information. So that's one line that WikiLeaks brings you to. The other, of course, is when we say arrest war criminals, not whistleblowers. Here we have WikiLeaks bringing out a lot of material about the war crimes of the United States in Iraq, Afghanistan, around the world, State Department material that's embarrassing to them, efforts to stop criminal prosecutions of people around the world that have committed war crimes. What we have now is another issue that's going on right now related is there's a number of cases now going on in which some of the U.S. war criminals, some of the people who've allegedly who've been involved in torture, may actually be facing serious stuff in Europe. And the two cases that have come up this last week were the Spanish cases, in which the Center for Constitutional Rights is playing a prominent role, in which a Spanish judge, Judge Ruiz, wrote a 19-page decision saying he wants to go forward with the investigation of the Guantanamo torture cases. He wrote this long opinion setting out the law that these were war crimes, they have jurisdiction to investigate these cases, and asking the prosecutor which people in the United States he ought to look at. Does it mean we're going to win? No, it doesn't at all. And you could argue that the opinion is slightly cautious. But it may be cautious, but it's a huge, huge step. So that's going on in Spain. In France, a judge just issued an order, or a magistrate issued an order, saying that the United States should give up all of the documents on three French detainees from Guantanamo who were tortured at Guantanamo, asking the United States, under what's called the letters rogatory is a technical term, but asking the United States for all of these documents, and asking the United States to give the prosecutor, give the prosecutor in France access to Guantanamo so the person can go and look and examine Guantanamo, and to give access to certain officials in the United States. So there's a big push to try and get that in France, but it's going on. There's three French detainees who were tortured, and that's the order. Now, I think the United States will utterly and completely ignore it. So that's going on in France. So you have Spain, France, and now in the United Kingdom, there's an investigation going on of the United Kingdom's role, this is really interesting, in transferring people to Gaddafi to be tortured. So imagine this situation. In fact, one of our clients, Omar Degahis, who's Guantanamo detainee in England right now, he allegedly was at Guantanamo for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons they claimed he was there was because he was opposed to Gaddafi. Obviously, what happened is they said somebody said, do Gaddafi a favor, pick this guy up and take him to Guantanamo, is what it looks like happened. But what also happened is the UK, at the request apparently of Gaddafi, sent two people from around the world. They picked them up, basically kidnapped them, and sent them in to Libya to be essentially interrogated, tortured by Gaddafi. Now, what's also interesting is one of those guys turns out to now be one of the leaders of Libya. So Britain's in this, like, ridiculous situation. This guy they then eventually tried to overthrow with NATO, or did overthrow with NATO, they were earlier cooperating with and sending his opponents to him to be tortured. Now they're in this situation where one of the guys they sent to be tortured by Gaddafi is actually one of the leaders of Libya currently. There's an investigation going on in Britain. So summary of it is, UK, France, Spain are all starting more seriously to look at torture. Again, this will be a story that over the next few years will unfold, much like the stories of Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange.
Several activists in Virginia have launched a website appealing to whistleblowers wanting to reveal evidence of corporate and government misconduct in the Appalachian region. The site is called honestappalachia.org. It uses a security technology to protect individuals who upload documents, and it keeps their identity hidden should there be subsequent legal action. Inspired by WikiLeaks, Honest Appalachia is a low-cost model that can be adapted by others around the world. To talk more about the site and the movement, we're joined by Jim Tobias, an activist and direct action protester. Welcome, Jim, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
You've launched an exciting new website, honestappalachia.org. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. Basically, the site is meant to be a resource for whistleblowers, and we've taken what is normally a very risky endeavor for whistleblowers, which is finding a trustworthy individual or institution to give documents to, and we've replaced that risky situation with a website that allows whistleblowers to anonymously and safely upload documents to our site, and then we will take those documents and vet them and distribute them to journalists for publication.
Jimmy, it's interesting that you're launching the website now, given the actions around the country and the attention to the Stop Online Privacy Acts. Are you concerned that that may affect posting these documents to the website?
Yeah, I think in SOPA, some of the provisions are so broad that a site like this could potentially be targeted or blacklisted by service providers. And so, you know, that SOPA is definitely, I think, a risk to transparency organizations and whistleblower resources on the web, and organizations like WikiLeaks and Honest Appalachia. I think, you know, SOPA could be potentially devastating to that, you know, that area of internet activity.
Jimmy, give us the website again, and how do you go about using it? Let's say I'm sitting there and I'm some whistleblower that sees my corporation doing bad things, and I can get some documents. What do I do?
So you go on our site. You would read our submission guide, which is a step-by-step process to using our online submission program. What the guide will tell you to do is to download Tor, which is a very simple piece of software that you can get from the internet that routes your computer activity through servers all across the world, which is essentially makes your activity anonymous. So nothing you do can be traced back to you.
Hold on for one second. And I always see the word Tor on almost everything I read from all these guys,
right.
T-O-R. And what you're saying is if I'm sitting at my little computer and I have an IP address, which if I tweet somebody from my IP address, Twitter knows my IP address.
Right.
Now you're saying there's a way I can download a program called Tor that when my computer tweets that, it goes through all these computers all over the world, and it goes on to Twitter from a different computer than my IP address?
Exactly. Your IP address basically gets lost in the crowd of the hundreds and thousands of servers that Tor uses around the world. Whistleblowers sitting at their computer, hopefully their computer at home, and not at the office, because that, you know, there are other security issues there. But with Tor, if you upload documents to our site, we could never trace that back to your computer. So we won't even know who you are uploading to our site. And so that really is a strong anonymity measure that was optional on WikiLeaks, but for us it's not optional. In order to access our upload page, you have to be using Tor.
Jimmy, do you have a background in technology?
I don't. The lead technical producer named Garrett Robinson, he developed all the software. He spent about a year researching and developing the software we're using on the site. He's created this open source platform that he's hoping to share with other activists trying to start sites of their own. But he, you know, a lot of this was his legwork and his research and his development, and that's mostly what we used the grant we received to do to develop this software. I should add that we use Tor, and that's one of the steps we use to secure, but we also encrypt the documents we receive so that, you know, a law enforcement organization got their hands on our documents, they wouldn't be able to open them because they're encrypted with very secure encryption technology, basically.
The goal is not only to have this site, but to have a model that others can adapt around the world, essentially.
Exactly. And we have information on our site about how others can take our open source software and use about 80% of it. And so get, you know, what took us a year to set up could take them only a couple weeks.
How come it has this name, Honest Appalachia?
Because we're focusing on the Appalachian region, and there's really two reasons we're doing that. One is because a lot of the people involved in this project either grew up or went to school or lived in Appalachia.
What region is that before you go to the next region?
Our project is really focusing outreach on Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, Virginia, also included in Appalachia, South Carolina, and Georgia. And so, you know, we're very open to documents from there as well. But we're really focusing our outreach on seven states, the seven states I mentioned.
For example, if I had information related to either corporate or government wrongdoing or corruption in Pennsylvania, I could upload information to this site.
Absolutely, and we would really encourage it. And, you know, you could be from anywhere. I mean, we'll accept documents from anywhere if people want to upload to our site, but we're really focusing sort of our outreach efforts and our media efforts on places like Pennsylvania, places like Ohio, and further south. The site launched last Tuesday.
Great.
It's kind of our first week, and we've gotten good media coverage, and we're just chipping away at outreach at the moment.
And what kind of documents do you expect?
We're really hoping to receive documents about wrongdoing or malfeasance at the state and local level of government from corporate entities in the region. You know, Appalachia is a pretty industrialized region, but it's also very rural. A lot of corporate activity goes unobserved, and we're hoping to kind of help fill the gap in the region.
Jimmy, are you allowed to mention who funded you for this?
Yeah, we were funded with a seed grant from the Sunlight Foundation. They gave us $5,000 to do the initial research and to get it started. And so that was the money that really allowed us to get going. And, you know, we actually spent less than the grant we received. So it's relatively cheap to get something like this started. And we're hoping that that model will, you know, will encourage others to carry forward and work on similar projects elsewhere.
Jimmy, what kind of bad acts have these corporations and the government officials that facilitate them in the past, what kind of things have happened?
You know, I think just generally there's a really cozy relationship in a lot of these states between industry and government. And, you know, I guess we're not really sure what they're doing, and that's kind of the point of the site. But I don't think it's a secret to anyone. You know, even, for example, the Upper Big Branch disaster in West Virginia.
What's that, a coal mine?
Yeah, it was a methane explosion in a coal mine, and 27 or 29 miners were killed. The federal investigators are finding that all sorts of lies were propagated about the safety conditions at the site. And, you know, a lot of these entities, whether they're coal and gas or banks, you know, they have such a cozy relationship, they can really get away with activities that they shouldn't be able to get away with. And we're focusing on a broad array of people, whether it's coal or gas companies, banks, zoning boards, state and local governments, anything that potentially could engage in corruption at the expense of the public.
Well, we're going to give you the Daniel Ellsberg Honorary Prize here. That's great.
Jimmy, say you accumulate a tremendous amount of information. Are you yourself going to play any role developing or taking this to another level, or is this purely a repository to be available for public access?
Basically, how we have it set up at the moment and how we plan to go forward is that when we receive documents, we're going to be very prudent with them because we don't want to put anything out there that's not true. And so we'll vet the documents and try to ensure that they're authentic and that they're not fabrications. And then we're hoping to establish relationships and work with local journalists in the region to vet them with a second pair of eyes or a third pair of eyes and to publish them in media outlets around the region. And so as much as this project is focused on whistleblowers, we're also really trying to support local journalists and local investigative journalists who have seen a real decline in their numbers, a real decline in their resources over the last 20, 30 years. This is almost as much about supporting and working with journalists as it is about supporting and working with whistleblowers.
Jimmy, that's just a tremendous resource. I think we all mourn the decline of investigative journalism. as the corporate media has established a stronghold around the country.
Yeah. Jimmy, can you say the website again? And I just want to say to all our listeners, I encourage you to spread the word about this new website, Honest Appalachia. Give us the spelling and the name and all that, Jimmy, and let's get it out there.
Okay, it's www.honestappalachia.org, and that's HONESTAPPALACHIA.
HonestAppalachia.org.
Appalachia, Michael.
Appalachia.
We're saying it incorrectly.
Both of us.
Jim, this is a remarkable project, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.
But first you must learn how to